Welcome to the Drinker, Biddle, and Reese second broadcast of Inside the Beltway. This discussion will be followed by a Q&A session. Audience members who wish to ask a question may do so by pressing star, then 1 on your touch-tone phone. These instructions will again be provided when the Q&A session is about to begin. And now I will turn things over to Fred and Brad.
Well, thank you very much, and hello, everybody. The election's over. After months and months of being bombarded by commercials, it's ended, and the Democrats continue to control the presidency, which means that the administrative agencies will continue to be run by Democratic appointees, presidential appointees. The Senate continues to be held, the majority, by the Democrats, with the addition of a few seats. The House continues to be held by the Republicans, although the Democrats gained a few seats, but it's the nature of the House that the party that has the majority runs the show. So what does all this mean for retirement plans, and particularly for participant-directed retirement plans? What does it mean for our world? I'm Fred Riesch. I'm chair of the Financial Services ERISA team at Drinker Biddle. And with me is Brad Campbell, who's also an attorney at Drinker Biddle, an ERISA attorney. But equally importantly, Brad was in the George W. Bush administration, the Assistant Secretary of Labor for the Employee Benefits Security Administration. So he's lived what we're about to talk about.
Hello, everybody, and thank you for coming.
Yeah. Well, as a little bit of administrative background, the program is recorded. We're being recorded right now. Within about 2 days, it will be posted on a Drinker Biddle website. That website is www.drinkerbiddle.com/beltway, B-E-L-T-W-A-Y. Now, if I went through that too fast, don't worry. We're going to send you an email if you registered for the program, as you obviously did, in about 2 days, and it'll tell you where it's posted, and it will give you the address. For future reference, all of these Inside the Beltway recordings are posted at that website, and you can access them whenever you want. In terms of the program format, Brad and I will go back and forth until about 45 minutes after the hour. At that point, we'll open it up to questions. If there are more questions than we can handle in the 15 remaining minutes, then we'll augment the program and go for another 5 or 10 or 15 minutes to the extent that you all continue to have questions. With that introduction, let me jump right into it, and I'll start off by posing a question to Brad. And it's the big question everybody's talking about. What's going to happen with the fiscal cliff? And as a subset of that, what the heck is a fiscal cliff? Brad?
Well, thanks, Fred. And again, thank you all of you for taking the time to join in. We're very happy that our second in this series of our new quarterly calls happens to coincide very nicely with the end of the election, so we can come to you and have kind of an interesting situation, which is even though by one measure everything's the same, more or less the same people are in charge, by the measure that counts, what's likely to happen, everything's actually quite different. And we're going to see some potentially very significant and fundamental changes coming at us here in 2013. And the fiscal cliff is sort of round one in this debate. So for those of you who haven't heard your fill of the talking heads on TV describing it, in essence, there are a number of expiring tax provisions that would collectively constitute the largest tax increase, more or less, in history, that expire at the end of the year. The payroll tax holiday expires, so payroll taxes would go back up at the end of the year. In Medicare, the fees paid to physicians will be reduced by about a third unless Congress does something. There are new taxes associated with the health care reform legislation, call it Obamacare, call it the ACA, whatever you prefer, that start. And significant spending cuts kick in, both on defense and other forms of spending, which relate to Congress's attempt to force itself to reach a deal earlier this past year, which failed. And because they didn't reach a deal, these cuts kick in. So all of that's coming to a head here at the end of the year. And the lame duck Congress, the Congress that is no longer going to be leading come early January, has to address these issues. And so you've probably seen on television the opening negotiations between Speaker Boehner and the President and the folks in the Senate about how they're going to address that. The president wants to have significant increases in taxes for folks earning more than $250,000 a year. The Republicans are saying they would prefer to reduce, to keep rates the same or reduce them and make up that difference by broadening the base, by reducing tax deductions, by reducing tax exclusions so that more is taxed. And where that leaves us in the retirement space is square in the crosshairs. If you look cumulatively at the amount of money that the government thinks it spends on tax breaks for retirement plans, both ERISA plans, non-ERISA plans, IRAs, kind of that whole kit and caboodle of retirement savings, in 2013, the government thinks that's going to cost $165 billion of uncollected revenue, which makes it the number two tax break in the code, number one being the associated breaks for health care, number two for retirement, and then a distant third actually is home ownership and all the tax breaks related to that. So we're front and center. Our industry, our system is front and center in the debate over where the revenue is going to come from. And that has the potential to be a very uncomfortable place to be. We are facing – I'm sorry, jump in there, Fred.
Yeah, Brad, I was just going to say that you know, it seems like everybody knows, and this is sort of a softball question for you. It seems like everybody knows that the tax break given to retirement plans is largely a deferral. That is, yeah, you get to deduct it today, but – at some point down the line, people have to pay taxes on much of that. How does that square with this being the second largest tax break, and how does Congress deal with that?
Well, and this is another reason the retirement system writ large has a huge target on its back. The way Congress scores revenue, the way they keep track, is they only look at what happens in the next 10 years. So in a system like the retirement system where, you know, the vast majority of retirement savings now is going to be taxed as ordinary income more than 10 years from now, Congress treats it as if that is revenue lost forever. So that $165 billion that, you know, is estimated to be the 2013 cost for all retirement savings, you know, ASPA has estimated in testimony before Congress that that's effectively double the actual cost, that if you calculate it on a present value, a more accurate way to measure what the real tax, you know, cost of the tax breaks is, it'd be about half that. So we start out with a disadvantage of being where the money is and have a second disadvantage of it being artificially inflated as to where the money is. And that's why I think most observers are very concerned that we are looking at the most significant potential changes to the taxation of retirement plans since 1986. And for those of you who tracked what happened in 1986, it was a different world after Congress got done making some changes to the tax treatment.
Well, Brad, to jump in again, I'm before I ask you the next question, let me set you up in a way, which is that I'm reminded of what Yogi Berra said about predictions when he said predictions are difficult to do, especially when they're about the future. So, with that in mind, what are the alternatives that are being looked at for retirement plans, and maybe focusing on 401k plans? And can you handicap those in any way?
I'll give a shot, but I'm glad you started out with that caveat, however inartfully expressed, that you're really taking a shot in the dark here. And this is doubly true when you're trying to predict what Congress is going to do at the end of a long tax negotiation, because at the end of the day, the deals are made at 2 in the morning by a bunch of people for reasons other than the policy they actually represent. So it's difficult to make some predictions, but I will say this. I think if you look, there are a number of proposals on the table of ways to do this. The Simpson-Bowles Commission and some other folks, Governor Romney, made some suggestions as to cap the overall amount of deductions or exclusions that would be available for retirement plans to 20% of income or $20,000, for example. That's one approach that people could use. It could have a significant effect on how people, the tax value they perceive of their retirement plans. Other ways that Congress could do it, and I think there are debates all over the map as to what would be the right way, is to just look at lowering contribution levels. Potentially they could begin taxing to some extent the inside buildup. They could means test the deductions or exclusions. So in other words, if you had above a certain income, you wouldn't get the tax benefit for retirement savings, but you would below a certain income. There are literally dozens of ways Congress might go about trying to capture some of that $165 billion of perceived revenue. And I think that's going to be the challenge going forward, is how do we protect as much of that as we can, but also to the extent we can't keep them from going after it, how do we steer them into the least detrimental cuts in terms of the incentive of businesses to offer plans and the incentives of participants to participate in them? Now, one other prediction I'll make. I think, you know, we're looking at this fiscal cliff debate, which is a very short-term debate. They need to work something out before the end of this year. I actually don't think that retirement plans are on the chopping block primarily during that period. I think that there's a general recognition that retirement plans, there's a lot of complex issues to work through, and I think the compromise that we hope they'll reach on the fiscal cliff to avoid going over it probably will not be focused on the retirement plan issue in the short term, but rather that will be something that's discussed in the follow-on, which is a broader debate over comprehensive tax reform. So I think we're really looking at two rounds of tax changes, the short term for the fiscal cliff, and then the longer term kind of a comprehensive reform of the whole code, a la 1986.
Oh, yeah, Brad, I was in Washington, D.C. about 6 weeks ago, and I met with some of the Senate committee staffers, the Finance Committee staffers, and they were of the opinion, as you said, that there's no way that in a matter of weeks Congress can put together comprehensive tax reform. That's just off the table because it's not possible. And they felt that it really wouldn't be appropriate to put in major tax changes that become effective mid-year. In other words, saying that they felt that whatever the new tax regime will be, that it really needed to begin on a January 1 rather than a July 1, for example. Therefore, it seemed to me like we're looking at any of these changes being effective January 1, 2014, rather than during 2013. Does that make sense to you as well?
Yes and no, but I think it's going to depend on the taxes, and that's why I say yes and no. I think there are some, in the debates they're going to have to reach a deal here in the short term, they're probably not going to cover all of the new taxes that will go up as a result of the expiring provisions of, you know, what are known as the Bush tax cuts. Some of those, I think, might be addressed earlier, and it depends on how long tax reform takes. They might be addressed earlier and made retroactive to January 1 of 13. Others, as you say, might be pushed forward to January 1 of 14. And I think that'll probably vary depending on which taxes they're looking at. A lot of that also depends on the revenue. If they make it retroactive to 13, then Congress raises more revenue, which makes their budget numbers easier to hold. So there's always this. The difficulty of this time of year is this type of a compromise, not this time of year, but this type of a debate, is it's driven by the numbers. So Congress will be looking at all sorts of interesting things to try to make those numbers work out. And the effective date and how you phase in changes is one of the bigger games that gets played in the score, the cost of tax bills.
Yeah, you know, talking about looking at the numbers, one of the alternatives for 401k and 403b tax reform that I've heard is to switch everything to Roth deferrals, which would have the perverse effect under that 10-year scoring system of working out better for Congress than it works out in the real world. Have you heard that as well?
Yeah, that is something people have been kicking around as well is, well, what if some portion of retirement savings was now essentially directed into Roth instead of the traditional form of taxation, which would raise revenue now for the government, and that 10-year scoring window works to their advantage. That's certainly a possibility. I really think when we get to comprehensive tax reform that almost all the options are going to be on the table, and it's really going to be a lot of day-to-day attention that's necessary from folks interested in the outcome here to keep pushing it towards the way that's sort of least detrimental to the incentives to employers, particularly small businesses, to offer plans and stay in this system.
Well, Brad, before I move on to regulations, is there any final thought on legislation? I mean, there's this view in America that, you know, the Congress in many ways is dysfunctional, but I think a lot of people are optimistic that they're going to that Congress will have to get together and deal with tax reform, with extending the debt limits, with balancing the budget. First, do you share that optimism? And then secondly, if we go beyond that to look at any other meaningful retirement plan legislation, do you think that the farmers and the ranchers can be friends, as they say in Oklahoma?
Wow, an Oklahoma reference. There you go. I am cautiously optimistic that they will work out a compromise. What I am less optimistic about is that we're actually going to like the compromise they work out. I do think that now that we're past the election, because going into the election, both sides thought they could win all the marbles and have, you know, more or less total control. And at the end of the day, we have essentially the same people in essentially the same positions. But now what we have is a train bearing down on us of mandatory tax increases unless Congress does something, and mandatory tax cuts unless Congress does something, combined with reaching the debt ceiling, you know, probably sometime in January, depending on what little tricks the Treasury Department puts in to delay that. All those things come together, sort of force them to have to work together to avoid worse outcomes. And in the way Congress typically does things in sort of the brinksmanship negotiations, essentially compromise happens when the pain of no action is greater than the pain of compromise. And I think for both parties, things are such that that's probably true here this year.
Okay. Well, on that mixed note, let's move on to the administrative agencies. The Democrats continue to control the White House. That means that the appointees at the administrative agencies either will continue as they already are, or that there will be new appointees for folks that move on. How's that going to impact the regulatory process from a, you know, philosophical perspective in terms of priorities? And could you give us a few examples of specific retirement plan proposals that we might see?
Sure. And, you know, as President Reagan used to say, personnel is policy. And in terms of personnel, you know, let's start with the Labor Department. We've seen Deputy Assistant Secretary Davis has you know, decided to go and pursue a career in the private sector. I don't know that we have any good idea of who might fill that position. But I think most people assume that Assistant Secretary Phyllis Borzi will likely remain. So I think the general policies and priorities that we've seen from the Labor Department the past several years will be continued in their regulatory agenda going forward. The most obvious of those is the rule, the proposed regulation to redefine the definition of a fiduciary advisor. What is the conduct that makes one a fiduciary when giving advice? What's sort of the definition of that? That's a really fundamental change to how service providers operate, who plans are hiring. It really changes a lot of different aspects of what goes on in the system. DOL had proposed a very controversial proposal back in 2010 that would make many more advisors ERISA fiduciaries, probably most, if not all, depending on how one looked at it. And for a variety of reasons, there was significant bipartisan opposition to that, in part because they also extended that same notion to IRAs, in part because they went after the valuations for ESOPs. At the end of the day, there were a lot of different groups impacted. And so in 2011, DOL withdrew the regulation, withdrew the proposal to work on it, to improve it, to address some of those concerns, with the intention originally of reproposing it in 2012. I think most of us believe that it was not reproposed in 2012 because it was so controversial that it was something they decided to wait and see if things went their way in the election, which they have. So Assistant Secretary Borzi has said publicly that they're going to move forward with a reproposed fiduciary rule. We would anticipate seeing that come out fairly soon. In fact, there was a rumor yesterday that, you know, they'd already sent it to OMB, which is the process by which the White House takes 90 days to review the rule prior to its publication. That was not actually true. It had not yet gone, but that is something we expect to see fairly soon. We expect them to take another run at that rule to repropose it. When they do that, and that'll probably be, you know, probably the earliest you would see it proposed is 4 months from now, that will then, you know, have a period of comments, which we'll all want to very closely read that reproposed rule, see what they're coming up with, how it fits together, and I think we'll all spend a lot of time debating the issues in that regulation.
Yeah, Brad, for you know, for those of you all who aren't governmental junkies, OMB is the Office of Management and Budget. And there is a process that when a regulation is proposed, that the particular agency, in this case the Department of Labor, sends the proposed regulation over to the Office of Management and Budget, which reviews it for a number of purposes. We don't get to see it. The private sector doesn't get to see that regulation as it's sent over or while it's under review at the OMB. You know, more or less it takes 90 days for the OMB to review a regulation. So that means that if it went over in February, that it might be May before we actually get a physical copy of that to look at. And sometimes a little faster, sometimes a little slower. There are rumors circulating that there's already been a fair amount of information exchange back and forth between the DOL and the OMB on that, which could speed it up. But I think that time frame is certainly directionally correct and as good approximation as any. My sense is that the new fiduciary regulation will actually be quite similar. The new fiduciary proposed regulation will actually be quite similar to the old fiduciary proposed regulation in terms of the definition of fiduciary. I do think there could be some substantial differences, though, in the series of prohibited transactions exemptions that are going to be issued at the same or proposed at the same time as the regulation. For example, Brad mentioned individual retirement accounts or IRAs. The private sector, particularly insurance companies, banks, broker dealers, were adamant that the regulation was overreaching when it came to individual retirement accounts. And in the IRAs in particular, it's not so much the enforcement of a fiduciary rule, because there is no mechanism for enforcing a federal fiduciary rule in the IRA arena, but instead the prohibited transaction consequences that can be enforced by the Internal Revenue Service under Code Section 4975. That is the real problem from the perspective of the people opposed to the rule. That, I think, will be where we'll see some significant changes, as well as some clarifications that may or may not be particularly helpful. Brad, that's sort of, just from, you know, reading the tea leaves, that's my best guess. What do you think?
Well, I this is one of those fun times, Fred, where I agree with you and I disagree with you. And I agree with you in that I think the general thrust of this rule is going to be largely unchanged. The basic redefinition of fiduciary is going to continue to remain very broad. And I agree with you that they are going to also at the same time now propose some new prohibited transaction exemptions to go along with this. For example, I think one of the big ones will be ways to address some of the broker-dealer concerns, such as being able to engage in principal transactions, even though they're now could now be fiduciaries for investment advice purposes. I think that's the kind of prohibited transaction exemption that DOL will put in there. I am much less sanguine, and here's where I might disagree with you, that DOL will actually meaningfully address the IRA problem. I think DOL views the IRA marketplace as essentially unregulated, and that they are very concerned that the same conflicts that they perceive themselves to be stopping in the 401k, you know, ERISA plan context need to be stopped in the IRA area. And so I think they're going to, I would be surprised if they actually proposed a prohibited transaction exemption that gave people a useful way to deal with some of the IRA issues. They may do that, and if so, I'll be very happy to hear that. But I'm very concerned, actually, that the IRA provisions might prove to be even a bigger flashpoint this time around than they were before, in part because I also think DOL is likely to add a new provision. If you look at the 2010 proposal, DOL asked questions about rollover solicitations. They asked for comment on whether DOL's position that someone who is not a fiduciary to the plan is able to go solicit IRA rollovers, talk to participants about distribution, and have none of that be a fiduciary conversation, not subject to ERISA in essence. It would be governed by securities law or insurance regulation or whatever it might be as sort of a seller conduct issue. I think DOL received comment back on that and will likely propose, and this is informed speculation, but speculation nonetheless, but I think they'll likely propose new restrictions on rollovers, whether it's making that rollover solicitation sort of a fiduciary conversation, whether it's some other structural change to try and put more parameters around those rollover solicitations. I think that's an area where DOL might take some new steps, which would be very controversial. So this is a place I think we need to look very closely when the proposed rule is finally published, to see what new wrinkles and twists there are in it with respect to IRAs.
Yeah, I don't think we're so far apart in what we're seeing. I do think there will be exemptions, a number of exemptions, but it may be that the conditions to qualify for the exemptions are not palatable to some in the private sector. So, but it and I do agree that there's going to be some heavier regulation of IRAs. I mean, if you think about the DOL's analysis, and keep in mind that they tend to get stories of things that go wrong. They don't hear the stories of everything that goes right. And, you know, they've been regulating retirement plans for years, and by and large, retirement plan investments are of good quality, the expenses are reasonable, and people accumulate benefits for retirement in a highly regulated, you know, and therefore somewhat safe environment. When you go to IRAs, the stories they hear are of people being sold investments with 5-10% front-end loads, 3-6% embedded annual expenses, and so on. And to them, I'm pretty sure it doesn't make any sense that you should have 30 years of accumulating benefits in a managed environment that is of relatively high quality, and then just throw the money out to where, you know, 3, 5, 10 years of that accumulation can be wiped out on day one. Now, those are the bad stories that they hear. I'm not saying that that's typical. So there is some, I think, desire at the department to be able to continue the high-quality environment and the regulated environment. And since they don't regulate individual retirement accounts other than simple IRAs and SEP IRAs, they need to get some connection there if they're going to achieve their goals. So I agree that we'll see some activity in that area, both in the regulation of IRAs through privative transaction exemptions and in the regulation of advice that participants receive about rolling over to IRAs. Moving on to another subject, you know, Phyllis Borsey at the Department of Labor and Mark Eary at Treasury, who I assume is also going to stay, have been working a lot on retirement income issues. That is, how can participants in retirement, either in retirement plans or in IRAs, have sustainable income that will last for their lifetime, even if they live to be 95 or 100? And when I was in some meetings in D.C., I heard informally from a representative of the Department of Labor that the first proposed regulation that would be sent to the Office of Management and Budget was a regulation concerning the projection of account balances, participant account balances in defined contribution plans as a monthly retirement benefit at age 65 or 67. So that could be the first regulation in line to go to the Office of Management and Budget now that the current administration has been extended by the election. Brad, what do you think about these retirement income issues generally in terms of Mark Eary and Phyllis Borsey and their support for those issues, and then even more specifically in terms of the projection of retirement income?
Yeah, the Treasury and DOL have been working together as sort of a broad regulatory project, ways to encourage more DBization of the DC universe, and one of the ways that they've been looking at doing that is dealing with retirement income issues. And out of the hearings and comments and so forth that have come from that, we've seen some proposals that Treasury has put forward and some regulations that they'll likely finish to try and facilitate longevity annuities and a number of other sort of very technical tax issues that I'll let someone more qualified than myself address. On the DOL side, whether it's the first regulation or not, DOL is likely to, in the first part of this year, put forward a proposed regulation that will include that income projection. Structurally, it will likely be in the form of the regulation implementing the periodic pension benefit statement requirements from the 2006 Pension Protection Act. You all have been sending out quarterly statements and annual statements, depending on the type of plan, since 2007 when those rules took effect, but you've been doing so based on your good faith interpretation of the statute. And DOL had never gotten around yet, and I don't mean that derisively, there was a lot to do. They hadn't gotten around to issuing regulations on that. They will likely issue a proposed regulation that addresses those issues broadly, and included within it a provision that there be some sort of projection of the monthly income that a participant's account balance would generate. And I think in concept, that's something that a lot of people think makes sense. The question, though, really is the execution. And that presents some very interesting questions that we're all going to want to pay attention to. For example, if I'm a 25-year-old worker and I've been defaulted into my plan and I've accumulated $3,000 in savings, if there's no projection made about future contributions, if there's no rolling forward of my balance to account for earnings on those projected future contributions to my retirement age, then I'm getting a lifetime income projection based on $3,000, and I'm going to get $10 a month in retirement. That's a real disincentive for that worker to stay. So how they go about doing this, what assumptions they make to roll balances, project balances forward, to then project income from, are going to be pretty critical. The other question is, will this be a mandatory disclosure, or will it be a safe harbor methodology that plans could use if they choose to make those projections? In either event, the methodology matters, but also the mechanism of mandatory or elective is going to be significant as well. And we won't really know the answers to those unless DOL gives us a peek until the regulation comes out.
Yeah, my sense is that Phyllis Borzi would prefer to have it mandatory, but that it is is an issue that, at least as far as we know, has not been resolved. My sense is also that it would be a projection of current account balances, and that therefore a small account balance for a young employee, although you have many, many years of compounding, wouldn't look that good. I think if that's the case, that the private sector providers are going to have to step up and say, and based on the following assumptions, here's some additional information. Here's what it would look like if you continue to behave in your current fashion, and you can go to our website and play with these assumptions, increase your deferrals, and so on. Then the next step would be that I think the private sector, mainly the providers, would have to give participants some sort of a benchmark. The most common benchmark is Social Security and, say, 401k plan combined should replace about 80 to 85% of final pay. And then the third step would be, again, private sector, probably record keeper or provider developed, would be gap analysis. Here's the gap between your current behavior and the benchmark. Here's what you need to do to close that gap. And I think all of that could flow within a few years of the Department of Labor issuing a regulation on projections, particularly if the regulation is mandatory. So I think there's a whole story to be told, and only the first step will be public sector. I think everything after that will be private sector as providers and record keepers compete with each other to provide the best and most meaningful services to participants. Also, I should point out that both Brad and I'm sure, will be actively involved in writing comments on these regulations once they come out in proposed forms. As you might imagine, we have lots of clients who have real interest in how these rules are developed and in the fact that they're developed sensibly. So there will be a comment period. We'll be among the people commenting. I'm sure many others will be as well. Also, some of the other things that the private sector has recommended about retirement income to the DOL, one, that there be a piece of investment education guidance that is where, much like Interpretive Bulletin 96-1 on investment education, that there be retirement income education and that there be a parallel interpretive bulletin. Another request has been that there be a 404C for retirement income. That is that if plan sponsors provide certain specified information to participants, then any retirement income decision will be viewed as being that of the participant, and there will not be a potential of fiduciary liability for the plan sponsor, the committee. And then third, there is a request that there be a better safe harbor regulation for a process for selecting insurance companies and annuity alternatives. There is a safe harbor regulation for defined contribution plans for selecting insurance companies and annuity contracts, but it's pretty vague, and there's a request that more specific guidance be given. I think there is at least some chance on a 96-1 equivalent and a 404C equivalent. I think it's up in the air as to whether or not we're going to get a better safe harbor for selection of insurance companies. Brad, I don't know if you want to add anything to that.
I would say I think that there probably is willingness at the Department of Labor to consider the 96-1 approach, the sort of more clear guidelines established where what you're telling participants about retirement income fits squarely in the non-fiduciary education camp, making that information more available. I think there is much more appetite for that at the Labor Department than for the other two.
Okay. Well, you know, those are the two main regulatory projects, but there are a couple other things that are kind of interesting. You all may remember that in Field Assistance Bulletin 2012-02, the Department of Labor came out with a complex piece of guidance on fiduciary responsibility for brokerage accounts, going so far as to say that if there were certain common investments among the brokerage accounts, that the plan fiduciaries could be deemed to have selected those investments even though they were chosen by participants. There was an uproar about that, and the field assistance, or the DOL came out with what is labeled Field Assistance Bulletin 2012-02R. I'm not sure what R means, but I think it means I changed my mind. or revised, perhaps. In that one, the DOL said, well, forget some of that stuff we said earlier, but don't forget it too much because we're still looking at the issue. In other words, we've been forewarned that the Department of Labor is seriously considering coming out with some additional guidance about brokerage accounts and 401k plans. Brad, can I turn it over to you to add some details to that?
Yeah, and the basis for their concern is very interesting. While it appears to be in many ways motivated by a belief that some folks had come to the conclusion that, hey, if we offer a plan that's nothing but brokerage windows with no designated investment alternatives, then we don't have to deal with any of this participant disclosure stuff under 404A5, and we can avoid disclosure. And I think that's one motivating factor at the Labor Department was a concern. But the legal mechanism by which they're coming out with this is, I think, somewhat troubling. The logic behind 404A5, the participant disclosure regulation, was that if participants are given the responsibility for making their own investment decisions and are, you know, responsible for the outcome of those, then the plan has a fiduciary duty to give them the information with which to make those decisions. And so they're one way they can be looking at brokerage windows, and this also seems to be implied with the revised Q&A on brokerage windows, is that this brokerage window only plan design might be per se imprudent because it's not providing, or at least isn't required by the regulation, to be providing that underlying information about the investment options. And what DOL was criticized for in the initial guidance was they were really, in the view of many, trying to issue a regulatory edict in the form of a guidance document. The enforcement approach they outlined was very specific. You know, if more than five participants invested in the same thing, or if more than 1% of participants in a plan with more than 500 participants invested in the same thing, then you would have this disclosure responsibility. And DOL seems to have implicitly acknowledged that controversy in the revised guidance by saying that they will begin dialogues with the regulated community on this brokerage window issue and may from there develop additional regulatory proposals. That dialogue is something they are serious about doing. I've spoken with staff over there recently who are looking for people to go talk to about these brokerage window issues. And they aren't just limiting those conversations to brokerage window only plan designs. They are also interested in talking more broadly about brokerage windows and whether additional information should be disclosed in sort of a more traditional plan menu that has many DIAs and a brokerage window. So this is an issue to keep our eyes on. It probably won't immediately result in a new regulatory proposal, but it's definitely an issue that's percolating and one the department will be spending some time on, I think, over the next couple of years.
You know, Brad, my sense is that the department, at least the current group of appointees and maybe beyond that, have operated for a long time under the concept that the fiduciaries for a plan select service providers for a plan, for example, a broker-dealer, and that the rules seem to reflect a concept that the fiduciaries are selecting all the brokerage windows as opposed to each participant being allowed to pick their own broker-dealer. Is that, do you think that's their view and that the rules might be written from that perspective?
I think that I think if you look at the history of the participant disclosure rule, that's kind of the assumption you would draw, that that's how DOL was looking at that process. I think part of their process of talking to people and discussing these issues will be to recognize that they mean that that likely is not the case, and that may influence their thinking going forward. So I would view this as an evolving issue and one we need to keep our eyes on.
Okay. On, do you think we're going to get any more guidance, any more frequently asked questions on 408B2?
I think we will, but I don't believe it's imminent. I know DOL is talking to people in the regulated community about their experience. You know, they're building over the course of the last year or so, people have been sending in questions that they've had for some time to think about. They've also been actively trying to engage with trade associations and service providers and plan sponsors to get more data about how it's going. And they're also going to have their enforcement process to start informing them with some real-world data about compliance and how are people responding to 408B2 and what are they seeing as they start asking for those disclosures as part of their routine enforcement questionnaire. So I think they are interested in proceeding with guidance and are in the process of continuing to work on it, but it's not something I think we're going to see in the very short term.
Okay. I know that my sense is that among the issues that are being looked at the department is the disclosure in terms of ranges, because some of the ranges that are being used are extraordinarily broad and as a result aren't effective information for evaluating the compensation of the service provider. A lot of people forget that the preamble to one of the earlier versions of the 408B2 regulation said that that they were not going to include health care and the 408B2 regulation, but they would be looking at that later on. In any sense, just as a very quick aside, departing from the retirement plan area for a moment, if there is any work on a 408B2 for health care?
Well, I mean, they have done work on it over the past couple of years. They got some additional information, and there was some movement on it. I don't have a sense that that is something that's imminent either, in part because there are so many regulations and work, so much work left to be done on implementing the Affordable Care Act, the Obamacare, call it whichever you prefer, that it's they're very challenged to get done all of the things in healthcare they're forced to do, and it makes it difficult to turn their attention to things they'd like to do. So I do think that's an issue that, given that they have four more years to work on, we may well see coming back around. But I also don't get the sense that that's a proposal we're going to be seeing popping up shortly. But, you know, this is a good point to bring up something, which I think I haven't heard a lot of talk about. You know, by law, the department has, and all the federal agencies, have to issue a regulatory agenda with listing the regs they plan to work on, the stage of the process they're in, and the timetables they predict activity to happen. And we're many months overdue in seeing the latest regulatory agenda. And many people speculated that's because of the election year. There was not a lot of desire to put out a new regulatory agenda and whatever questions it might raise in the middle of that process. Now that the election's behind us, I think most of us are anticipating we'll fairly, in a reasonably short fashion, see that new regulatory agenda. And when we see that, there are probably going to be some new surprises on there. It'll give us a real sense of what their plans are. For example, on the 408B2 for health services, they'll put some timelines on it and tell us when they think the proposal will come out. So we're going to see a lot of new information here over the next couple of months whenever that regulatory agenda is finally released. And it's going to give a good window into what the new policy priorities of the second term of the Obama administration are.
Brad, I want to talk for a moment about enforcement. And, the DOL enforces through investigations. It seems to me that looking back over the last 3 years or so, and which would reflect the activity of the Democratic administration and the current leadership at the DOL, We've seen a fairly significant increase in investigations of service providers, broker-dealers, record-keepers, RIAs, and so on. And, my belief is that the department is beginning to realize how much influence service providers have over 401k plans, particularly in the mid-market and for small plans. First, do you think I'm right? And so three questions. One, do you think I'm right that there have been more service provider investigations? Secondly, any comments about those investigations? And third, and more broadly, any big comments about DOL investigations going forward, not just the service provider investigations?
Yeah, I think DOL has always realized the influence and importance service providers have and the very significant role they play in the whole employee benefit process, but I absolutely agree that they have very much focused, targeted enforcement on service providers over the past year or two. Whether that was to establish a baseline of compliance to then compare the effect of 408B2 and the other disclosures to, two or three years from now to see how much increase in compliance there was due to the new rules, whether it's for that purpose, whether it's just they felt it was time to really bear down on service providers in conjunction with the new disclosure rules, it's hard to say. But there's unquestionably a significantly greater focus and a lot more proactive targeting of service providers as service providers for enforcement actions. So that's definitely going on. I would say just a word about it going forward. We're going to see the 408B2 and the participant disclosures, 404A5 disclosures, become a standard part of their questionnaire when they're going and investigating a plan or a service provider. And my general sense is that I think they will be more friendly to plans in terms of trying to help get them to compliance rather than trying to drop an enforcement hammer on them than they will be to service providers. I think there will be a bit of a double standard, and I think there will be a higher level of compliance and sophistication expected of service providers and therefore a little more difficult time in enforcement proceedings than there will be on plan sponsors. So I think we'll get a little bit more of the benefit of the doubt in complying with these new regulations and all of their splendiferous glory.
Yeah, two comments on that, Brad. One, we're already seeing the DOL ask for the 408B2 disclosures when they're doing investigations, even
right,
though those investigations are of the 2009-2010 plan years. In other words, the DOL, the 408B2 disclosures weren't even due until July 1, 2012, but I think they're picking them up and sending them back to the national office to get reviewed. Which is part of the trying to get a feeling for what's really going on that you were talking about earlier. Secondly, just to give everybody some general time frame, I have marked with a red X on my calendar July of 2014. And why is that? Well, the first major set of 5500s for 2012 will be filed around July 2013. And DOL investigations, more or less, tend to begin a year after that, or July 2014. So I think we'll get our first major wave of DOL investigations of 408B2 disclosures in the middle and latter half of 2014, even though it will be looking back to what happened just a few months ago. So that's what I think the time frame of all of this will be, although it could get accelerated a little bit because I think it's a big issue for the department.
Yeah, I would generally agree, but I wouldn't rule out enforcement actions in 2013 focusing on the disclosure rules as well. Often, they'll look at the last 3 years, and once we're into 2013 and it's now, say July of 2013, we're now a year past the effective date of 408B2. So those requests should be including at least 1 year where it was actually effective. So I tend to agree with you in general on the time frame, but I do think on this one they might also accelerate it.
Yeah. Well, why don't we open it up for questions? Operator, will you open it up for questions and tell people what they need to do?
Absolutely. To ask a question, you'll need to press the star, then 1 on your touch-tone phone. Again, that is star 1 to ask a question.
Brad, while we're waiting, do you think with advisory opinions and prohibited transaction exemptions, which we haven't really talked about, the department is going to that it'll reflect the perspective of the Democratic administration, and if so, how?
Well, I mean, certainly the you know, advisory opinions and so forth are always influenced by whoever's running the department. So the, you know, the views of whichever political appointees are in charge obviously are expressed in those. That's the value of winning the election, is you get to impose your policy views. In terms of how they'll come out, I think that's really going to vary depending on what the issue is and whether people are asking for advisory opinions and on what topics. I think if I were going to make some very broad generalizations, there's, I think, a low level of trust for the financial services industry. So, you know, exemption requests and advisory opinions that seek to give, you know, more latitude to financial service providers are not likely to be well received. I do think one thing that's worth pointing out, though, is, you know, there's been a lot of turnover in leadership in the Office of Exemption Determinations. You know, the new director there, Ms. Hall and her staff, you know, there really has been significant turnover, and so I think there's going to be a lot of opportunity to go have new conversations about what exemptions should be out there, whether there are new class exemptions that would be appropriate. So I think there's going to be a renewed focus on the whole exemption process. That could turn out to be good or bad. It's really hard to say from the perspective of those applying. But I think there's an opportunity to see some, you know, different activity in the exemption area than we've seen in the past.
Operator, are there any questions?
Yes, we'll take our first question from Steve Rabinow with Stifel Nicolaus. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks very much for the presentation. It was great. As I understood you, it sounded like certain changes which might take place in terms of generating revenue from qualified plans, which may be passed in 2013, may be retroactively applied so that they would apply back to January 1st of 2013. So I just wanted to hope you can clarify that a bit. I mean, for example, tax deductions, people are putting money into a plan, they're expecting a certain deduction, might something like that be taken away? Just a little clarification on that, if you wouldn't mind. Thank you.
Brad, I think that was you. Do you want to jump
in?
No,
it's hard to predict what Congress might do. If they decide to make it retroactive to January 1, 2013, you know, let's say it's July and they've passed comprehensive tax reform and they made it retroactive to January 1, people who had planned to put in 17.5 to their 401k, who, let's say they, you know, chopped the limit down to 12 or something, you know, might have to make some adjustments there on a very quick fashion to deal with that. Or Congress may alternatively decide that it's too difficult to make that switch in midstream and put them going forward, January 1 of 14. You know, for a matter of administrative complexity, you would want it to be prospective. From Congress's desire to capture revenue, they would want it to be retroactive. So, you know, I say flip a coin and see which they do. And I think it might even vary from provision to provision. Some provisions in the same comprehensive reform might be retroactive while others are prospective. It's very hard to predict the details of this kind of a tax debate, unfortunately. But you raise an excellent point. All of us are going to have to sort of buckle our seatbelts and be prepared to not only fight about this during the debate, but live with the administrative issues that are going to be presented after they finally decide.
Thank you.
Yeah, I would be more of the school of thought that something like the 401k limits would be prospective. I think the things that can, if there is anything that's retroactive, the things that can be most easily made retroactive are tax rates themselves, because, you know, the income was earned and it's being taxed at a higher rate. It doesn't really challenge your behavior, but if you've made charitable contributions or large 401k deferrals or you know, spent money in other tax-encouraged ways in the early part of the year, I think it would be there would be a lot of pressure to not make it retroactive. I agree with Brad that once these things get momentum, you know, these deals are so huge that the smaller issues just get rolled over. But that one bothers me conceptually, to think that you know, Congress would take a tax-encouraged form of behavior and then retroactively punish it. I just don't think that would sit well with a lot of people.
Thanks very much.
Sure. Operator?
And once again, if you do have a question, you may press star 1 on your touch-tone phone, and we'll pause for further questions to queue.
Yeah, so the question is, was our presentation so complete that there's nothing left to ask about, or are you just so depressed by what might happen that you can't summon the will to ask one?
I'm actually surprised that folks don't have more questions about the fiduciary rule and about how what they think the impact's going to be. And I will tell you one thing, just as sort of asking the question or one small part of the question myself and answering it, we're seeing a shift within the advisory community, broker-dealers, RIAs are already there, but broker-dealers particularly, at the margins still, but in two ways. One, more and more broker-dealers are setting up RIA programs particularly for non-discretionary investment advice for participant-directed plans and allowing their advisors to be fiduciaries as non-discretionary investment advisors, meaning that their compensation has to be level, not only at the individual advisor level, but also at the broker-dealer level. I mean, combined, they're aggregated as a single entity and it has to be level. Also, there's that concern about functional fiduciary status. That is, what if the registered representative of a broker-dealer or what if an insurance agent gives advice that they think is non-fiduciary, but upon closer analysis is individualized investment advice based on the particular needs of the plan or the participant, and as you probably expect, what I just defined was fiduciary advice. But they find out that functionally after the fact. Well, some broker-dealers and others are saying, gee, where's the real problem there? And the real problem is compensation. It's variable compensation. So if the broker-dealer can levelize the compensation of the aggregated entity, including meaning the broker-dealer and the advisor in most cases, then there's no prohibited transaction, even in the functional fiduciary status. So the two takeaways from that are, one, we're seeing more and more RIA programs at broker-dealers, and two, we're seeing more and more of a movement to levelized compensation where retirement plans or IRAs are involved. So I think some people are anticipating the regulation and adjusting for it already. Operator?
Yes, we'll take our next question from Skip Schweiss with TD Ameritrade. Please go ahead.
Gentlemen, thanks very much for the content. I enjoyed it a lot. Wanted to focus on the potential for reduction in contribution limits to retirement plans. I'm strongly opposed to that, given our savings crisis we have in this country. And I'm wondering if you can provide any suggestions about how we can best convey our messaging to whom and what our key messages might be, maybe in addition to the pointing out it's a deferral, not a deduction. Thank you.
Just very quickly, and then Brad can jump in with more detail, but my experience in Washington, D.C. is that trade associations are one of the most effective ways to advance your message. So for the broker-dealers, if it's SIFMA or FSI, for third-party administrators and record keepers, it could be ASPA or SPARC, and other organizations like IRI that represent insurance companies and related broker-dealers. I just think the best way you can do it is to work with the different trade associations you belong to and almost insist that they be active on this issue. And I don't really think you're going to have to do it because the message I'm getting from those trade associations is they're actively engaged. Brad?
Yeah, no, the trade associations are fully geared up, and I would add to that your plan sponsor trade associations, American Benefits Council, plan sponsor, PSCA, I forget, they changed their acronym, so whatever that means nowadays.
And ERIC,
Risk Industry Committee. There are a lot of different trade associations that will be all over this issue, but that doesn't mean that there aren't ways you can help as well. I mean, it's helpful that message is echoed when you run into your member of Congress at the local town hall meeting. So certainly this is an area where you need to stay involved. I would say in terms of, what you were asking specifically, what are some of the arguments that can be made in defense of the current system? The criticism from the left is, in particular, is look, 17,500 is a large number. Most participants don't come close to that. So really, that part is benefiting your more highly compensated workers. And that's an awfully inefficient way, in their view, to do that. If we capped it at a lower amount, the rank and file would still be contributing as much as they ever were, and we wouldn't be, you know, giving this tax giveaway to the rich when we could use it for something else. There's a lot of different problems with that particular argument, but one of which I would point out is there's a reason the employer and the employee's incentives are tied together in the tax code, and the system is structured the way it is. If you remove the ability of the small business owner, for example, to get any personal benefit out of sponsoring a 401k, that substantially reduces the likelihood that that small business owner will want to continue to offer one and deal with the fiduciary liability and the expense and, you know, all the things associated with running a plan properly. And if you start reducing the availability of plans, that very rank-and-file worker who you said wouldn't be harmed because he doesn't contribute $17,500 will be harmed because his plan may disappear. And the only way that lower-income worker is ever saving for retirement, if we look at the numbers, is through a plan sponsored at work. You know, people who have lower incomes don't go out and open IRAs of their own motion. When they're saving for retirement, it's because there's a workplace plan. So there really are issues that this isn't just, you know, high income versus low income. This is, does, as an employment-based system, these incentives have to balance out so that there's a desire to offer plans for workers to then participate in. That's just one of the series of arguments that are out there, and I think you'll be hearing a lot more about those trying to justify the current system. I say that as if it needs excessive justification. How about trying to defend the current system?
Yeah, my sense, ASFA has done some research that shows how much rank-and-file employees save when they're working for an employer that has a plan versus how much they save if they have to do it on their own because their employer doesn't have to have a plan. And the numbers are just staggering. So there is good data that way, and on that particular point, you can get it from ASFA. But I would also second what Brad said about your local congressman. If you know your local congressman, or if you can go to their office and talk to the people there, that carries more weight than you might think. Everybody wants to talk to the Senate Finance Committee or the House Ways and Means Committee because of the power those people have. But your local congressman is accountable to you, and that matters. Thanks, Kip.
Thank you.
And we'll take our next question from Agnes Apontis, self-employed. Please go ahead.
Hello, Agnes.
Go ahead.
Agnes, please check your mute button.
Hello?
Yes.
Good afternoon.
Thank you.
I would actually like to ask two questions. First of all, how could you defend the current system with all the troubles they're having?
And what was your second question?
And my second question, if you could briefly explain to me why all the employees of Enron Corporation were left without retirement funds.
Okay.
Just briefly.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that highlights a couple of important reforms that have been made to the system since Enron, and it also highlights an important reform that we ought to make in the future, which is removing some of the barriers to providing professional investment advice in plans. Right now, the prohibited transaction rules make it very difficult for most participants to have access to advice, and the first thing almost any advisor would tell you is don't invest 90% of your retirement in the single equity, the issue, you know, the employer stock. So a lot of those people's very real problems could have been avoided if they had access to professional investment advice, which unfortunately is a position that a regulation on that we had put out in the Bush administration was rescinded by the current administration. In terms of defending the system as a whole and its troubles, obviously no system here is perfect, but I think in general we've been doing a pretty good job of getting people enrolled. The changes in automatic enrollment, the changes with the QDIA regulation are getting more people participating in the system and more people saving for retirement, and that's the direction we want to go. And my concern with the tax treatment debate is that we may make progress the other way, which makes it harder for people to save. And I think that's a concern we should have. Operator, do we have another question?
Yes, we'll take our next question from Steve Patterson with Cherry Investment. Please go ahead.
Well, the question that I wanted to ask was just asked, so I'll let somebody else do it. I appreciate very much this conference call. Thank you, guys.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
We have no further questions in queue at this time.
Well, everybody, this is Fred Riesch again. Brad and I want to thank you for attending the call. We're doing these on a quarterly basis, and so in about 3 months you'll get another invitation, and we'll at least see what the early returns are on some of our predictions. Also, keep in mind that these audiocasts are posted on the website for the law firm, and again, that's www.drinkerbiddle.com/beltway. In about 2 days, you should get an email reminding you that, or letting you know it was just posted and giving you that link. So thank you very much, Brad, and thank you.
No, and thank again, all of you, thank you for attending. We very much appreciate it. And if you have any questions, I'm in our Washington office. Feel free to give me a call. Fred's in our LA office. Feel free to give him a call. We'd be happy to talk to you.